gives us a nice model for understanding simple spin physics. And one of the things that many physicists find useful is to be able to take some new problem and map it onto something that you understand. And so we'll keep this one. So we have our neutron interferometer. There's a phase flag here. And you know, we've looked at this in pure states, we looked at this in density matrices. And we could just ask, well, what is this the equivalent of? And given that we have the effective rotations of all of those operators, then of course we can combine those into one effective rotation. And there are many ways of doing that. You know, you can just multiply everything out and then extract what the overall operation is. That's pretty easy. Or if you like, you're a bit old-fashioned, you can use quaternions and extract the same thing. And here, we have a nice simple result that this is an effective rotation about the x-axis. And so if I take the whole neutron interferometer, and as we've done in the past, you know, we could say, okay, this will follow the rotation here and here and here and here. But okay, we don't need to do all that. We just say that what happens is that we have a rotation by an angle phi that keeps us in the yz plane. And then, of course, here, we're making measurements along the plus and minus z axis of that. And what we see are the two intensity curves. Okay, and so we get all that nice and compactly. And remember, that we describe this as a Ramsey fringe experiment. In the Ramsey fringe experiment, every time somebody drops an unknown quantum system in your lap, and you say, oh, is it going to be a good quantum system? Then you want to be able to do a Ramsey fringe experiment, because if I look at the dependence on phi here, remember, at this point, we've created a superposition. You know, it's not so interesting to say what happens with the eigenstates of a quantum system. You know, if the eigenstates don't remain as they are, well, you barely have a classical system, right? I mean, a classical information processor. So you say, okay, what I want to know, if I have a quantum system, is can it be coherent? And so since the Ramsey fringe experiment ends up measuring the fringe as a function of this phase evolution while the system is in a coherent superposition state, the Ramsey fringe experiment tells us how coherent is the system. And at some point, we may go back to De Vincenzo's rules. You know, everyone here has heard of David De Vincenzo's rules, right? It says, you need at least these things to have a quantum computer. And, of course, they were invented in 1997. And if he had a chance to reinvent them, he would change them. But they're still good rules. And so one of them is that you better have a system that's coherent. Yeah.
Could you say a bit about just how the Ramsey fringe, the fringe curves or results show how coherent the system is?
As I change the phase, do the fringes stay big? right? That's what you require as a quantum processor. As I change the phase, the system doesn't decay. Okay? We'll see that at the end of the class today. So here we have our system. Very simple. We can measure the fringe. We can see, is the system coherent? And then we added something. What we added was we said, well, what if we put a magnetic field here? And we reminded ourselves that the spin, that the neutrons have spin. And so what you end up with is a neutron with some momentum going into an area where there's a magnetic field. And let's call this case of zero to make it a point. It has some momentum. We know what that is. We've set it very precisely. And of course, it's going to have the same momentum out there in free space. But here, there's a potential. And this potential depends upon the spin. Right? So we wrote down a Hamiltonian. We said that we had a Hamiltonian that was gamma B sigma Z, the spin dependence of the neutron. And so what will happen is that there'll be a momentum in here if the spin is up, and there'll be a momentum if the spin is down. Because, of course, sigma Z for the neutron spin is going to take on two values. It's the spin 1/2. It'll either be plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. And so this potential that the spin is moving in will separate the two spin states. And after this, they've transitioned through there, then although the plane waves for spin up and spin down would be in phase here, well, they would be out of phase at this point. Now, of course, the experiment we're doing is to say, I've got a neutron coming in, and it has either spin up or spin down. And then it's going to take these two paths. And we'll have an interference effect. And that interference effect, whether the neutron goes to this detector or this detector, depends upon the phase difference between those two paths. And, okay, so we have a phase blade here to set that. But, of course, now we have another phase shifter from the magnetic field. And if the spin is up, okay, then it's going to introduce one phase shift. And if the spin is down, it'll introduce another phase shift because the neutrons are moving at a different velocity because there's a different potential. And so we end up having an additional term here that says, yes, if the spin is up, I get an additional rotation. And if the spin is down, I get a rotation in the opposite sense. And so instead of having what we've been describing it as one experiment, just thinking about neutrons, we have two flavors of neutrons. Neutrons spin up, neutrons spin down, and they each get a contrast curve. And we calculated that for you. So here I'm just looking at the O beam intensity. And the two contrast curves that go from plus 1 to minus 1 are the O beam intensity if the spin is either up or down. And you can see that they're shifted in phase, right? And that shift in phase is exactly this shift in phase here. And of course, since the energy depends upon field, think this small b as the magnetic field strength. The bigger I make that magnetic field, the bigger that change in the phase will be. And the blue line is simply the average of those two. Right? And so the blue line says, hey, you're going to have a different sort of contrast, a different sort of modulation of the output depending upon that magnetic field. And let me just write it down here. So if I have Now, instead of one vector here, I've got two vectors. Then if we take the average of those two, we'll move inside the block sphere, right? And then the further apart they are, the more we'll move inside. And so what we'll see is a cosine modulation of the phase, and let me just call it phase sub m for magnetic. And so this piece here looks very much like an amplitude modulation. And there were some engineers in the class. If you ask your engineering friends, they'll tell you if you have the sum of two phase modulations, that results in an amplitude modulation. So if I want to have an AM radio, I should take two FM radios and beat them together. And then I get the nice AM radio, which is what we're doing here. And this piece here, because the spin is always there, we see effectively another fringe, right? That as I change the field strength, we get to beating, and of course, the full intensity comes back in the observed signal, right? So here we could talk about having two fringes, a magnetic fringe, this term, and this coherent fringe. So here I'm using coherent too many times. I apologize for that. But this is called coherent because it's the coherent cross-section of the neutron interaction, not because it's, in fact, anything coherent. So here we would see what is normally called a coherent cross-section, and here's the magnetic cross-section. And they both give us fringes. Okay? Now, the point of doing this is to say, oh, yeah, now then I move inside the Bloch sphere. I have mixed state dynamics. But the interaction, the magnetic interaction, is incoherent. Now, of course, we hear of decoherence in quantum information processing. Incoherence is a special version of that, where the underlying distribution is classical and where we can remove it in the end. I'm going to look at that piece that says, hey, we can remove this underlying distribution. Okay? But before I do that, yeah, question. The spin is up or spin is down? Other questions? Now, let me make a point here. In this drawing, what did I show you? I showed you that the neutron plane wave was coming in. So this is traveling through space. And it spends some time in this area of high magnetic field. And then its K vector changes. And then it spends time back in the vacuum. And of course, its K vector returns to what it was. But there's a phase difference, because one lagged the other. And it's important that that happens before we reach this blade, right? Because the interaction with the blade, Bragg scattering, is very dependent upon the momentum of the neutron. So if we had the magnetic field overlapping the blade, then we could influence the Bragg condition, and then depending upon how we do it, we would no longer see interference effects. You had a question. I'm going to show you. Give me a few seconds. If I don't answer the question, then ask me again. Okay. Now then, we have this nice setup. And we see that the two vectors move apart. And then, of course, they can move back together. And they move back together depending upon the strength of that field. Now, let's conceptually look at another picture. What would happen if I put another magnetic domain here? And I make the magnetic field over that domain negative. But otherwise, I'm going to keep it as exactly the same geometry from here to here. I'm not going to vary anything else. What will happen? That's right. They cancel out. Does everyone see that? It says that, hey, in the first instance, we pick up this change, this spreading. And then because I've changed the sign of the field, they come right back together. And therefore, we remove this dependence on the magnetic field, and we go back to pure state dynamics. And that is called an echo. And as you go through quantum literature or spectroscopy, you'll find lots and lots of echoes. There's a rotary echo, which was the first echo. Then there's the Hahn echo. Then there's the 90-90 echo. There's a stimulated echo. And there's a magic echo. And I can keep going, but I won't. Gradient echoes. And they're all just exactly the same, except, you know, someone wanted a new name. They all say, hey, you have some underlying distribution, which because of that underlying distribution, you've created a difference in phase. And now you do something to remove that difference in phase so you end up back having a simple pure state dynamics, even though you still have this distribution. And of course, by having an echo, you extend the effect of coherence, but you lose information, right? By making this echo, I lose any information about this area where there's a magnetic field, right? So it depends upon what you're trying to achieve, whether you want to use an echo or not. You had a question?
That second operation you play.
So I would call the echo, so you'll find that people refer to an echo, to an experiment as an echo. But what I'm referring to here is the recombination of the states for the different elements of the distribution. Okay? So what I'm saying is the echo is that point where the blue and white vectors come together and we return to something which is, if not pure, at least closer to being pure. Yeah? But you will see that experiments are called echo experiments. And unfortunately, the shape of a measurement is sometimes called an echo. So it gets used a lot. Okay. Now, we've got this echo. Remember that the echo is only saying, I had the classical distribution. The classical distribution was right here. Okay. Now remove that. Now what happens if the spin changes state? Right? If I have a magnetic spin, then the spin is only aligned in a certain direction for some lifetime, normally called T1, the spin last relaxation time. We'll describe that later. But the T1 depends a bit on the environment of the spin. But it's not long, some fraction of a second, depends upon where you put the spin and what happens around it. But what happens now if in between this magnetic field and that magnetic field, the spin flipped its state? And that, of course, is a common error. That's a common reality. It also happens in your classical computer, right? That the error in your memories is that the magnetic moment of your domain flipped. Okay? And of course, you know, we can assign some probabilities. We will assign some probabilities. But I want you to think about what happens if between these two, and how long is that? Well, we said it's 20 microseconds to get through this interferometer. So something on the order of 10 microseconds is, you know, a real time. And the spin might go from being up to down or down to up. And you want to be careful in thinking about this. It's tempting to say, the initial spin state, it's half the time up, it's half the time down. So it's the identity operator. And if I take the identity operator and I flip the identity operator, I'll get the identity operator back. But remember, in looking at all sorts of dynamics, you're going to calculate the dynamics and then average afterwards, right? Don't average before you calculate. And so even though this is in the identity state, the way you have to think about it is that spin is either came into the interferometer either up or down. So now before I hear the answer, how many people know the answer?
Well, I think.
Okay. Not enough. So take 2 minutes. Talk to your neighbors. Find the answer. Yeah.
What's the question?
Thank you. The question is that when the neutron enters this area of the magnetic field, it goes faster or slower depending upon whether the spin is up or down. And that introduces eventually this magnetic phase. What happens if between going through this magnetic field and this magnetic field, the spin has flipped from being up to down or down to up? Okay, how many people know the answer now? Oh, you guys aren't helping each other enough. So.
So I guess, well,
describe it completely for the class.
Well, so they don't cancel out anymore. In fact, you add up.
Did people hear him?
So yeah. They don't cancel out anymore. So what is that? So I have to speak in there.
You have to speak.
Hello, on test. Oh my. Okay. So the magnetic fields don't cancel out anymore. In fact, the phase difference is now twice as big. And, well, that's it.
Great. Now, do people understand that? Good. Now let's take and look only at what would happen in one of these regions. So I have the neutron coming in, and for me, I'm just going to put the neutron spin up for now. I have to choose one, so I'll choose that one. And then we go through this magnetic field. And I'm going to describe the phase difference of if there was no magnetic field and there is a magnetic field. So we have our neutron coming in, it's got this plane wave, e to the I kx, let's call that x, minus omega t, and it's propagating, and I'm only concerned about what happens when that momentum changes, that wave number changes. And so I can say, well, what's the phase as a function of length or time, right? They're proportional. And this phase is the phase difference. What would happen if there was no magnetic field, and what happens with this magnetic field? And so, it increases. And then it stays flat, right? Because now, there is no magnetic field, so everything's just propagating. And, of course, the longer I made that, the bigger the phase I could get. All right. Now, a spin flip is a random process. So it's a little bit of an artifact. It's too artificial to say what happens if it flips between those pieces. But it's just a random process. And so we say that there's a probability that the spin flips. And I'm going to take that probability to just be a function of a characteristic time. So I'll say T sub C is a characteristic time. So that would be a relaxation time if we integrated this all up, and I require that t is much, much less than tc, so I can just think about this as a differential element. And so we say, oh yeah, there's a small probability, as long as t is small compared to this, that the spin flipped. Yep. And of course, the probability that there was no flip, well, that's just 1 minus it, right? It either flips or it doesn't flip. And then I can look at this and we can say, well, here, I'll take some small interval in time. So there's my t. It's an interval in time. And there's some probability that the spin flipped during that time. And if the spin flipped, well, then the phase would start accumulating with the negative sign. Of course, it has to start from where it was, but it'll accumulate that way. And of course, all we've said is that the probability over any small interval that the spin flipped is constant. So, hey, there's a probability it flipped there, there's a probability it flipped there and there. There's a probability it flipped just as it entered this range, this magnetic field. And of course, this picture says that it flipped only once. Well, let's build it up. So it says, oh, it flipped only once. And so if it flipped only once, this is the range of possible final phases. Now, of course, if T over TC is small and this is short, the probability that it didn't flip at all might still be the highest probability, right? All of these others, of course, at this moment would have equal weight. But then if you allowed a second process or a third process, right, then you could see that you could fill this in a more complex fashion. Looking at this figure, you ended up at a certain phase at the end for this particular neutron, depending upon a random process. Right? That the difference of ending up here or ending up down here is solely this random process of when did the spin flip. And so now this piece, because you've built in randomness, this you cannot refocus, right? Because you don't have access to when did the spin flip. That information is lost. In the original experiment, with only one magnetic field up there, you had access to did the spin speed up during the magnetic, in that magnetic piece, or did it slow down, because the spin state was preserved. But here, you no longer have access to that. And so this process is decoherence. And what separates incoherence from decoherence is in incoherence, you retain information about how you ended up at the final state. In decoherence, you've lost that information. Now, it's an amusing piece that as we control quantum systems better, we learn better how to find what that underlying process is. And so historically, you can see things that used to be thought of as decoherence getting pulled into incoherence. As we control systems, we learn better. But here, the piece I want you to keep is that decoherence is a fundamental loss of information. Okay? Yeah.
Down? Why is this squeakiness?
That's a great question. You say, well, it started up, why doesn't it flip to a superposition state, right, instead of flipping down? And the eigenstates are special, right, that they're resilient against a wide range of noise. So this is a limited model, and experimentally, you might find much more complicated dynamics, okay? But I use it because it's going to allow us to do a simple computation. And then I'll give you the tools to calculate this for any general model. But yes, to say that I have a spin flip isn't a general model of all the decoherence mechanisms, even for just one spin. Yes?
When you say that the process is decoherent because the spin flips at a random time and we lose information irreversibly, doesn't the information about when the spin flipped get stored somewhere? It can't be erased, can it?
That's a great question. Okay. Complete digression. But you asked for it, I'm going to give it to you. So now, we look at that first blade. I have a neutron coming in. You know, and someone might have told you that a neutron is small, but a neutron is big, right? I mean, that's practically a proton. So a neutron coming and hitting this piece of silicon shoves it over. And we have two possible outcomes, right? We've got the neutron going this way and the neutron going that way. And to a good approximation, I can say, well, this neutron didn't interact. With the blade. And this neutron bounced. And so necessarily, it gave some momentum to the interferometer. And this really sounds bad, right? Because if we go back to our neutron interferometer, and I know which path the neutron took, then we lose all interference. And it's not if I know, right? It's if there is a measurable difference. Then we lose interference. So why does neutron interferometry work at all? I think this is equivalent to your question. Do you agree it's equivalent?
I don't see that yet.
Okay. Thanks. So here I have an interaction. And over there you're saying, well, something in that magnetic area must have known that the spin flipped, right? There was a memory somewhere. Here, I'm saying, yes, I have an interaction, and something in this blade must know that the neutron was scattered, and there's a memory. And it's a question of, is that memory able to reconstruct the process? If it is able to reconstruct the process, then we no longer have coherence here. Then we have a deterministic state because there is a measurement we could make. You know, if you come in, put your finger on that, and feel if the blade is bumped over by the neutron. And if it is, you say, oh well, it's in this path, therefore we'll have no interesting effects. So that's the way I'm trying to connect those two. Okay, why do we have interference?
Are you able to distinguish between the reverberation of the blade due to the bouncing of the neutron and quantum?
Yes. So if you're asking let me try to put this in a clearer sense. Here we have a blade. And of course there are many modes in that blade. And we could say, oh, I have some phonon spectrum in that blade. And if it's not a question of, let me say what it is instead of what it's not. If the phonon spectrum is not changed by the interaction, then you have coherence. So how many people know what coherence states are? How many people know what a harmonic oscillator is? That's a little bit better. Okay. Somehow along the way, you missed a lecture. We'll pick it up later. I won't describe it right now. Think about this blade as a harmonic oscillator. And so with a harmonic oscillator, we've got lots and lots of states. And nicely, they tell you about the number of states of a harmonic oscillator. And then we can say, well, we're experimentalists, so you can forget those things. And so you have a distribution over these states. And maybe a little bit nicer to put it like this. Yeah, I need it like I was. I like that better. I have some distribution over these states. And so the information in this piece is broadly spread out. And as I come in and the neutron interacts, it leaves information, but there are so many phonons, there's so many excitations in this process that there's no way that I can distinguish those two. And you can write that down formally. You can take the two states, show that you can add an excitation to it, but that this distinguishability of those two states is zero. The same thing happens here, that I could say, oh, I have a neutron coming through a coil, and that coil has a quantum state, the classical state, the current, but I can always describe it in terms of the modes of that coil. And of course, whether the spin is up or spin is down, there's a back action. And so, yes, that coil is going to, in some sense, is going to, in a very real sense, have a change in its state due to the interaction with that neutron. But the distinguishability of those, the overlap of those, would be zero. Yeah, the overlap will be one, the distinguishability will be zero. Let me try one more thing. I'll try two more things. Let's say instead of having this magnetic field here, I put a squid. So a superconducting quantum interference device that can measure one flux quantum, which is really small. And the neutron goes through. And then with some beautiful electronics that no one's ever put in a neutron interferometer, you could tell that the neutron went through. And the Hamiltonian to describe the interaction with this or the interaction with that are exactly the same. And in this case, we would lose all contrast because now we're taking a pure state, we're changing that pure state in a way that's dependent upon the neutron being there. But in this case, I have a thermal state and I change the thermal state, but not in a way that it retains the information about the neutron being there. Yeah?
So does that mean that if we use a blade that's cooled down to approximately zero temperature, that it wouldn't work?
That's right. If I use the blade, it's even... The analogy I like maybe better is to say, let's take a really, really, really light blade. Right? And then I take this light blade and now I scatter off of it. And now because it doesn't have as many modes, then it would not work. Yeah? I mean, if you cool it down, if you just take a big thing and cool it down, there's a bunch of zero-point motions. So, you know, how cold you'd have to get. But if you take a light blade, then you could say, oh, yes. At some point, the blade will know, and you'll no longer have interference effects. So it's not, if you're thinking about leaving information behind, and destroying a quantum process. It's not about the fact that you left the information behind. It's whether you left the information behind in a distinguishable fashion. Okay? All right. I have to get back to where I was. Okay. So, in the notebook that I give you, I go ahead and calculate what you see with the fringe as I allow spin flips. And the calculation is here. And it's worth looking at. All I do is to integrate the stochastic Hamiltonian, which is described by this process, right? That say that every instant in time, either nothing happens, and I pick up one phase, or something happens, and I pick up another phase. And if you're looking at this, and you know something about Krauss operators or Lindbladians, you're going to be tempted to say, oh, you could do this that way, which actually you could do it this way. But don't try to take my analysis and say that it's a Krauss operator. Because the spin that I'm looking at is not part of the Hilbert space, right? The Hilbert space we're looking at here is only the Hilbert space of the neutron. And the spin is just a classical label of whether that interaction is going in the plus direction or the minus direction. Okay? So we're just integrating a stochastic equation. And I integrate it using recursion, just breaking it up into time steps. If you don't know what recursion is, look it up on Wikipedia. It's a useful technique. And at the end of the day, there's the fringe that you get. So this is a plot of the intensity of the output of this as a function of the length of that magnetic domain. So here we have only one magnetic domain, and I'm changing the length of it so that there can be more and more of these spin flips. And you see that the fringe visibility decreases. And of course, everything goes to 0.5, which is what it should be, right? Because when there's no contrast, half the neutrons hit each detector. Yeah. So here you get a nice simple picture of what happens as you add a random process to this. In the numbers, I had to choose some numbers to integrate. The numbers are just randomly chosen. Yeah.
For the Hamiltonian stochastic Hamiltonians, which you might give me an introduction.
So the stochastic Hamiltonian says, with probability this? No. Come on. You've been in the class for 3 days now. There's nothing formal here. It'll keep that way. With some probability, we're applying this operation. We go in one direction. And I'll call that M for magnetic, right? And that is this blue and white piece. And with some other probability, we go in the other direction. Okay? And so it's exactly what we showed here. We're going in this direction until some event that says we're going in that direction. And of course, since I'm integrating it every time step, I allow for some more complicated process. And we integrate over all those paths. And then we see this nice result. Now what I'd like you to do for one of your problems is to ask the question of what happens as I change this characteristic time. Well, if the characteristic time is really long, then of course the probabilities are really low, and we get a nice fringe. Okay, so we all got that. Now make the probability short. And something rather special happens when the probabilities become extremely short. And so I want you to explore that. And using this picture, you can probably see the answer already. Perhaps. But I want you to actually calculate that as well. Okay, to show that as the, you know, you think that as a probability of having a spin flip becomes large, that we should lose all the coherence in the system, right? We're doing lots and lots of random things. And what you should find is that's not the case. I'm going to take the next 5 minutes and describe one last thing so that we can move on to other pieces. If I have a neutron interferometer, let me draw the neutron interferometer from the side for a second. So we have this base. Remember, we've machined it out of one big crystal. We have a base, and you know, the blades go back. And forgive me for not drawing the whole thing that way, but these are macroscopic pieces. And the neutron beam that comes in is also a macroscopic beam. It's about 2 millimeters by 8 millimeters. So the neutrons are very monochromatic. But they're distributed over an area. And so every time we get to a neutron, it arrives at some random location. Okay. We saw from the contrast curves that if I have 40 microns of silica, that corresponds to a pi phase shift. So when I'm machining this blade, if on the surface of this blade I have roughness which is on the order of 40 microns, or if even worse, if instead of having the blades be straight, if the blades did something like that, then of course I would lose all contrast, right? Because then the neutron coming through here is different than the neutron going through there. All right. We don't do that. We're better at machining than that. But we do have some surface imperfections that are random. Now, of course, every blade and every surface have surface imperfections. Right? And these surface imperfections say that there's going to be an additional phase. So there's going to be a phase due to the surface. And that's going to be about the z-axis. Now we want to model this because this is important. But before I model it, you know, it's tempting at this point to say, okay, I'm going to put a Gaussian distribution for each of these. We'll integrate and we'll integrate and we'll integrate. We can all integrate Gaussian, so it's great. We'll get the right answer. But we don't actually need to do all that because we know that the incoming beam is an eigenstate of the Z operator, right? Therefore, the surface imperfections on this side of the blade, on the incoming side of the blade, well, they don't matter, right? Because they commute with that state. And we know over here that we're measuring in the Z eigenbase. So then the surface imperfections on the outgoing blade, on this side of the outgoing blade, don't matter. And so we say, well, okay, these we can't see, those we can't see. Now, between this surface of the blade and this surface of the blade, I only have Z operators. And if I have a bunch of rotations about the same axis, whether we're talking classical or quantum, we can add them all up. So you say, oh yeah, I'm going to take these, I'm going to take these. I'm just going to add up those imperfections into one imperfection. And the same thing, of course, is true here. I'm going to take these, and I'm going to take those, and we'll add up the imperfections, and we'll get one imperfection. And then there's the middle blade. But the middle blade was this nice pi rotation about y. And so a pi rotation will take sigma z to minus sigma z. But the imperfections are random. So they're just averaging random anyway. So the sign drops out. And so we can take all of the imperfections and we can assign them to any one surface we like. Let's just put them all here. We add them all up. And now we have one set of imperfections. There's imperfections on every blade. But we're left with one set that is going to be an honest model of this device. Yeah. We're adding random things. So remember, if I have random processes in the classical world, think about a random walk. If I take a random walk, and then I say, oh, I'm going to take another random walk, and I'm going to add those two events, then the walk gets broader, right? It can never get narrower. No, you don't believe that? Okay, good. So that's what I'm saying here. That random processes always add. So the fact that the operator changes sign doesn't matter because I'm adding a random process. I'm just always going to add the RMS width of the distribution. Okay. I'm not going to show you. I'm not going to go over the calculation. It's here in your lecture notes 3. But in this animation, I show you two sliders. The first is this transmission probability. Remember, the transmission probability says what is the width of the first and third blades, right? And that what we should see is that when everything is perfect, we get a high contrast, right? And that says the transmission probability is 50%. Yeah? And then, let's just leave it there. And then I add to that noise. And of course, what noise is going to do is to decrease those. And if we look somewhere here, there's the experimental data. And so now you have all the tools to find the approximate right values of the noise in the transmission for this particular interferometer. So in this case, we've got a complete measure, and you can see how the whole thing works. Okay? So have a look through that. There's a description in there about creating a spatially dependent phase. I think really it's contained in the description that we had with the spin, so I'm not going to go over it separately. But you know, if you have questions on it, let me know. Okay? Good. Sarah, there was a question about when they're going to know which problems to do. Okay.
For the assignment?
Yeah, what the assignment is.
Friday.